Pocket?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's recording now.
It's recording now. Okay. I think it'll work. Hi, everybody. We'll start. I'm Dr. Leader. I'm the HIV adult director. Hopefully, I've met most of you during orientation, but I'm going to talk to you today about how to manage the treatment-naive patients. So during orientation, I was telling you guys about testing. And actually, I've heard we're doing pretty good on inpatient testing, but we can always do better. I looked the other day. We're getting about half of the inpatients on the medicine service, it looks like, referred for testing. So keep it in your mind. Try to talk to them about going for testing. Anybody notice any problems getting inpatients tested? Any problems you're having about talking to the patients about the idea of getting HIV tested? Speak up, now's your chance. Okay. Let's talk about the management of the treatment-naive patients. So, next slide. I don't know if I need this. So we're going to start off with a couple of cases. We'll start here and then we'll launch into actually the didactic part. So ST is a 56-year-old white man. He presents to your clinic for initial management of HIV infection. He was diagnosed 4 months ago at the local health department when he underwent testing after learning of exposure from a previous sexual partner. He has no signs or symptoms of an opportunistic infection. His past medical history includes a myocardial infarction, hypertension, and dyslipidemia. His T-cell count is 420, and his viral load is 83,000. Prior to his appointment, you review the lab results and determine that it may be prudent to recommend initiation of antiretroviral therapy. This recommendation is based on which of the following factors that mirrors the recommendations of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services panel on ARV guidelines issued November 3rd, 2008. Okay, so this is the part where you guys get to jump in. All right, and I don't like people being silent. You're going to have to see this. So you're going to start him on antiretrovirals. Is it based on his plasma viral load being greater than 75,000? Is it because of emerging data showing no difference in all-cause mortality when ARV is initiated CD4 counts between 350 and 500 compared with lower CD4 counts? Is it because earlier initiation of ARVs may cause reduced cardiovascular or other non-AIDS-related disease risk? Or is it because the risk for OIs decreases when treatments initiate CD4 counts greater than 500 compared with CD4 counts between 350 and 500?
3 is correct, but I don't know.
3 is correct. Okay. So let's see. Let's go on. We're going to come back to these at the end. So I'm not going to tell you what. So the presentation really meant to fill in these gaps. So keep in mind, we'll come back to the same questions at the end. Which of these lab values or conditions would not influence the choice of initial regimen for patient ST? So these are things that would not influence your choice in medications. Would it be a plasma viral load greater than 75,000? Is it a history of MI? Is it a history of hypertension? Or is it a history of dyslipidemia? Which of these things do you think would not influence your choice? Hypertension? Okay, keep that in mind. Anybody have any other answers? Hint, anybody have any other answers? Okay, all right, keep that in mind. We're going to come back to after the presentation. After assessing his readiness to take medicines and addressing factors that might limit adherence, you negotiate a treatment plan. He commits to being on antiretrovirals. Given his current medical problems and treatment-naive status, is there any class of drugs that should be avoided as initial therapy? Okay? Should you avoid non-nucleosides? Should you avoid nucleoside reverse inhibitors, protease inhibitors, CCR5 antagonists, or none of these classes needs to be excluded as a group? Number 4? Okay. Anybody else have any other answers? Okay. I think there might be one more question. Okay. Nope. Next. Different patient. 35-year-old African-American woman was screened in your office. She tests positive for HIV on rapid testing. Western blot confirms her results. Her only risk factor is 3 male sexual partners in the past 6 years. She reports she's not currently active sexually. She has no current medical problems, and she takes no prescription medications. Her initial CD4 counts 387. Her initial viral load is 46,000. She's very nervous about having an infection in her body and wants to start treatment as soon as possible. Next. Which of the following would not be an indication to start ARBs in this patient at this time? Would it be if she had hepatitis B virus infection that needs treatment? Would it be pregnancy? Would it be a history of atypical squamous cells of undetermined significance, HIV-associated nephropathy, or OIs? Which of these things would not be an indication to start antiretroviral therapy in this patient? One? Okay. Any other? Okay, good. How many people in the room feel lost? Anybody? Everybody know everything here? Okay, we got one person. Everybody knows all these guidelines and rules and stuff, so we don't have to go over anything? No. All right, so let's go over, let's start in the basics. So we skipped ahead. We went through probably about 15 years of data that's led up to the current decisions about treatment. So where are we right now in terms of treatment? Actually, if you look at the different panels for guidelines, there's Department of Health and Human Services, there's IAS, International AIDS Society, USA, there's the British HIV guidelines, and there's a European guidelines group. What they'll all say is the threshold for starting ARV therapy is CD4 counts of 350. Used to be also a viral load factor into it, but now we're saying CD4 counts of 350. Also, if you have symptomatic HIV, so if you have 350 and you're having oral thrush, or if you have 350 and you're having any kind of shingles, if you have anything that's really truly associated with HIV, those are patients that you would think about actually putting on ARB therapy. So 350 and higher if you're symptomatic, 350 and lower if you're asymptomatic. Clear? Why 350? Anybody? Where'd they get this number from? Why don't we treat everybody? I always ask the same question whenever I do this. So some of you guys are PGY2s and 3s, you hear me say this each time. Why not treat everybody? We know this is going to progress in 90-95% of people. We wouldn't say, see, you have a positive PPD, let's not treat you. Let's just wait till you get tuberculosis. We don't do that.
Side effects?
Okay, that's probably really what guided the old therapies. Side effects. What else?
Opportunistic infections start the more chances to get as the CD4 counts.
Okay, that's probably also part of it. When the CD4 counts are lower, is when you have risk for OIs. How low is when we usually start prophylaxis? 200, yeah. That's when we start PCP prophylaxis. What else is another reason why probably these guidelines say don't treat everybody?
Resistance,
right? These are the concerns. Now, honestly, you guys take care of patients. You see the patients coming in the house. Do you think someone's more adherent when their T cells are 200 versus 400? No. You don't say, well, you have hypertension, but I'm going to wait until you actually have a heart attack, and then I'm going to start you on antihypertensives, right? We don't do that. So I think these things will change with time. I think some of this is actually to the fallout from past regimens, which were much more difficult than current regimens in terms of adherence. But it doesn't make sense in terms of a public health approach to this, because what we're doing is we're leaving a lot of patients out there viremic. And if those patients don't adhere to safe sex practices or avoid sharing needles, they can transmit virus. So that's something. So don't be surprised. These guidelines came out in November 2008. They usually are updated every 6 to 12 months. That if not this next round of the guidelines, the ones afterwards may change. And there's lots of different guidelines groups. So you may see some of this start changing again. Used to be actually we said, and we didn't even have very good therapies. T cells 500 and less treat people. So it kind of has gone swung from there down. Don't be surprised if it swings back up. Next. When to start? So ARB is less than 350. So where did this come from? Why are we starting to rethink this? There's a large trial called the NA Accord, North American Accord Study. I forget what the ACCORD stands for. But it's multi-sites and thousands of patients that are involved in it. And one of the things actually able to do with this is actually look at odds ratios, relative risk. And so they saw actually if you deferred ARV therapy until the T cells were less than 350, those patients actually had a 70% higher mortality associated than if you started them earlier. And what was most of that mortality? It was not opportunistic infections, because like you said, they don't start until your T cells are much lower. It actually, we're waiting for the official data, but it's going to be things that probably in the past we didn't really attribute to HIV that much. Things like cardiovascular events. So we'll wait for the data to come out, but this is one large study which is actually pushing us to say, you know what? There is a mortality risk associated if we wait longer rather than start people earlier. It's one study, thousands of patients. It's not prospective. So we also, you know, we don't have the prospective study out there to look at. But if you look, actually, if you compare sort of the mortality associated, well, older age also is associated with increased mortality. We know that in everybody. So, but the order of the odds ratio for deferring therapy is the same as if you actually were a younger patient compared to a patient 10 years older. Baseline CD4 count actually was much less of a factor in terms of having a significant adverse impact in terms of therapy. So we'll have to see. This was in New England Journal. You guys can go back and read it. But it's an interesting initial finding, actually, about arguing that maybe we should start earlier, not wait until the T cells are 350 or less. Next slide. This actually even looked at deferral of ARV therapy until T cells are less than 500, and there is still a significant change. If you start people rather than defer people. Next. And if you actually look at hazard ratios for this NA Accord study, and you compare it to CD4 threshold, you start seeing actually not much difference until you get to this 350 range. And then from there up, if you don't put people on therapy, you start seeing big differences versus treated versus untreated patients. So again, you know, I think we'll start seeing changes in these guidelines as time goes on. But for now, it's 350 and less is the recommendation. And there's a few other ones, which were on some of those questions that we'll get at. Next. We're seeing actually patients now with HIV dying from different things. You know, people are now with therapy are living a lot longer than they used to before. So we see, you know, less AIDS deaths as people, you know, are on ARV therapy. And we're starting to see things like, you know, non-AIDS malignancies, cardiovascular deaths, liver-related deaths increasing. Next. If you look around the world, though, one of the big problems has, and this gets back to testing, is that when we find patients, including at this hospital too, we're finding them with AIDS diagnosis. So the CD4 is less than 200. So if you look in North America, the average patient at time of testing has a CD4 count of 187. Here at Jacoby, half the patients that when they test on the emergency room, CD4s are under 200. So that's why I turn to you guys and say, you have them on the floors, and you know, the patients get so many other tests on. You don't have to do anything more than call 35211, and somebody will come up and see the patient. We'll get them tested. So if they didn't get tested in the ER and they get up to the floor, just call them. You can always call me. You can always call these folks, our counselors, that are sitting behind you. So just, you can always call 5211. We'll get somebody up there. Okay? So you can see around the world that still, you know, I guess only out here, maybe Japan, is anybody above 200 for mean CD4 in terms of diagnosis. So we're still finding patients way too late. And what does that mean when patients have had the virus and they're being diagnosed at this point in the game? That means they've probably transmitted the virus to other people too. And it's actually been, there's been some mathematical models looking at what's called test and treat. So if you find people right away and start them on treatment, drive their viral load down, we do know actually that, at least from some limited studies, those people are less likely to infect others. Makes sense. Their viral load's lower. Well, the viral load also decreases in, you know, in semen, in vaginal fluids, so probably the chance of transmitting is less. And so there's actually this interest in doing test and treat, identifying patients and starting them earlier on therapy than before. So there's clinical benefits to starting ARV therapy. You avoid AIDS-defining illnesses. But other things of why we want to actually put people on therapy, well, pregnancy. We know that women that are pregnant have a risk for transmitting HIV to their infants. And so starting them on therapy decreases that risk significantly. There was a big pivotal study done in 1996, which just looked at AZT monotherapy. We don't do monotherapy. Why? Because the virus gets resistant to monotherapy. But in this study, just using AZT monotherapy, so 25% of women that were not treated transmitted to their infants. With just AZT monotherapy, it was down to 8%. Now, we don't do monotherapy. We actually give combination therapy, and with good combination therapy and suppression of virus during the pregnancy, it's usually less than 1%. Some folks will even go as far as doing C-sections on top of that, and it reduces it even less. HIV-associated nephropathy is another reason to put people on treatment. So your CD4 count might be high, 500, but if you have HIV-associated nephropathy, that's an indication to treat patients. Hepatitis B co-infection, we should be treating those patients. Actually, the medicine Truvada, or at least tenofovir even, is a very effective antiretroviral against hepatitis B and HIV. So it does actually double duty. So that's one that we really want to think about in terms of treating your patients who are co-infected, treating them both. We don't have really strong data for our hospital in terms of actually how many patients have active Hep B, but I think it's higher than we think. So if anybody wants to do a little project, I have a project for you. But it would be to do a serial survey on actually looking at our folks here and how much Hep B we have. But I think it's higher than we actually may think at base value. So, SAP, one of these trials where they looked at what were the impact if you started therapy right away versus delayed therapy for patients who had tuberculosis. Open label, so patients knew they were going to be treated for both or just treated for tuberculosis. Patients to be eligible had to have both TB and HIV, so the N was 642. The baseline CD4 count was lower. You can imagine, just from the testing data I showed you, most patients are diagnosed to have CD4s less than 200. Some of the patients actually had MDR-TB. They were randomized to one of three treatment arms. One was an integrated arm where ARVs were initiated during the intensive phase of TB treatment. Think about what happens for anybody who's had a TB patient on the floor. Probably what was happening, what the doc told you is here, we'll treat the TB first, we want to avoid immune reconstitution, so we'll wait, and then we'll start thinking about TB. Or we'll say, oh, there's too many pills, let's just do the four TB meds now, and then later on, we're going to do ARVs. So that's what this is actually testing. Is that a valid strategy or not? So integrated is initiating ARVs during the intense phase of TB treatment, both at the same time. ARVs are initiated after intensive phase of TB treatment. Sequential is ARVs are initiated after TB treatment is completed. Patients receive standard TB regimen and ARVs with, actually a regimen we don't use too much in the States, but this is an international study. It was done with using DDI, 3TC, and Systeva. It was stopped early, this study, by the review board, the DSMB, and I'll show you why. Next. We'll go on to the next slide. So why was it stopped early? So if you looked actually, so the intensive phase of TB treatment, four drugs, then continuation, so most patients going into two drugs. Here's actually out 7-8 months, and that's enough to adequately treat TB. At that point you had integrated arm, TB and ARV treatment started together, and this is the sequential arm. So TB has been treated up to this point, and now the patients are starting on ARVs. And what we're seeing here is actually survival probability. And what you see is after TB treatment, the curves are starting to display. You're seeing the separation actually happening after, which argues that it wasn't just because, it wasn't something that was going on during the TB phase. It's something going on after. That delaying therapy in this pretty sick population of patients with T cells of less than 200 for the most part actually led to a decrease survival in the patients that waited until they completed TB treatment to start on heart. We saw a little bit of evidence of this in an opportunistic infection trial that was done about a year and a half ago, where it was patients mostly had PCP, and they did, again, integrated versus sequential therapy, and there was a trend towards, if you treated both at the same time, there was a better survival outcome. So I think this is challenging. So the next time when you guys are on the floor, especially you have an HIV patient who's got tuberculosis and attending saying, well, let's treat the TB first and then we'll worry. I'm worried about adherence. Yeah, come back. This was actually got a lot of play, this abstract, and say, I heard Dr. Leader talk about this SAPIT trial. Okay? And then they'll usually will give you bad marks when you finish your rotation. So, okay. When to start ARVs, treatment as prevention. So this is what we had talked about before, was that actually, that maybe if you treat HIV initially, you can decrease some transmission to the partner. Okay, next. And this was actually a study done in Uganda, and what they did was they looked at actually people that were on ARVs, not on ARVs, on ARVs, and on a conservative regimen ARVs. And they looked at actually the serodiscordant couples, so one person positive, one person negative, and then linked infections. And of course, if you're not on ARVs, what happened? You had more transmission. So people that were on ARVs who saw less transmission. So this is sort of the first test of this, I told you, this test and treat sort of approach of putting people on to really also decrease HIV infection. And we kind of know this. We sort of have lived this. We know that the chance of actually people being totally on behavioral modification and reducing transmission works for some people, but not for everybody. And it's probably not the best way to treat an epidemic. So, So this is from Uganda, but it actually looks like the first test that maybe test and treat is a way to actually handle the epidemic. Next. So what are treatment regimens that are out there? I didn't bring the pills with me. Sometimes I do and sometimes I don't. Today I forgot to. Preferred regimen for a non-nucleoside is Systeva, efavirenz. And there's a lot of reasons how we got to this point of what's preferred and what's not. We can go over that. Preferred protease inhibitors are any of these. What's nice about this one's atazanavir, which is also called Reataz. Small R means it's boosted, ritonavir. Boosted means that the ritonavir actually by itself, it's a protease inhibitor, but it's not very well tolerated. It causes a lot of nausea. But at much lower doses, what it does is it has this beneficial effect for other protease inhibitors of inhibiting the P450 system and boosting their levels. So in this case, one ritonavir a day with 300 milligrams of atazanavir, you get very good drug levels unless you do once-a-day dosing. The same for this protease inhibitor, which is called darunavir, unless you do once-a-day dosing. Nexiva can be used with ritonavir, but the pharmacokinetics here is twice-a-day dosing. And here for Kaletra, lopinavir, ritonavir, it can be dosed QD or twice a day. Why is this important? Well, anybody who's going to do HIV or ID in the future, this will be important in terms of what I'm going to do for treating my patients. But in terms of just practicality, and this is why sort of the guidelines are changing and why we talked about before we were much more conservative and why things may change, there's now really good once-a-day treatments. Efavirenz is once a day. One pill once a day. This is one pill and one pill once a day. There's now really good, effective once-a-day therapy. And so this hesitancy about delaying therapy because we were worried about pill burden or complexity of regimens, it's now actually really changing. There's alternative regimens also out there. Sometimes people don't tolerate the ritonavir even at low dose, so you can use atazanavir without the ritonavir boosting, or fosaprenavir without dose with the ritonavir twice a day. Actually, this should be QD as an alternative regimen. And sequinavir, ritonavir twice a day is also an alternative regimen. Now, when we do HIV therapy, we don't do one medicine by itself. And there's a lot of reasons why. It's just basically the viral mutation rate will eventually develop resistant virus. So we use combined therapy. So the choices are either this or this group as preferred therapy with tenofovir and FTC, which is also known as Truvada. What's nice has actually happened is the manufacturers of this regimen combined with the manufacturers of this regimen and put together a once-a-day pill. So it's actually now available, and a lot of patients are on it. One pill once a day is their initial regimen. And you can imagine, in terms of adherence and ease of regimens, that's a lot better than where we were before when it was multiple doses and multiple pills, patients having all kinds of problems with adherence. Another very effective regimen, tenofovir and FTC, that's a combined pill called Truvada. As long as their renal function is okay, you can use also atazanavir or ritonavir once a day. So this amounts to one, two, three pills once a day. Or Truvada with persistent ritonavir, one, it's actually two pills of darunavir, one pill of ritonavir. So, you know, I bring this up because actually when you're on the floors, if you start thinking about kind of what I'm saying, what I'm arguing for, when you're on the floors and you see those patients that are not being treated and they have they're HIV positive, take a long look why. And start thinking with your attending, why are we delaying this patient on therapy? Now, they might say, well, we're worried about resistance. Somebody, I think I pulled that out of them, said, well, maybe resistance. I think Fouad, I said, and he reeled you in and said, well, maybe resistance. Resistance is a particular problem probably of the non-nucleosides because really there, skipping a few doses, these are pretty fragile in terms of developing resistance. But these aren't. And actually, a lot of the trials using these protease inhibitors combined with Truvada, they're very robust in terms of actually not developing much in terms of resistance. So things are really changing, and I think the thought behavior and who we treat and who we don't treat is going to change. I would say in the past, one of the common things I would see is, you know, not with this house staff and not with your predecessors, but those old bad house staff, years and years ago, patients would come in, they would stop the ARVs. That was like the first thing. Stop the antiretrovirals. Now, remember, the TB treatment said sequential therapy doesn't look so good. So stopping antiretrovirals is probably not a good thing. And putting people on ARVs is probably a better thing. And probably, I would argue also, putting them on while they're in-house, where you can observe them, might be the best thing. And sometimes you build up good adherence to regimens just from the few days they're in-house, which can translate into patients actually going home being confident they can actually stay with the ARV therapy. So I think that's what you want to think about. Okay, next slide. So what this does in terms of the nucleosides, I'm sorry, go back one, Aaron. So if you looked actually here, there's alternative choices. And really for the long time, for a couple of years now, the alternatives really, the preferred therapy was Truvada, combined pill of tenofovir and FTC in one pill, versus Abacavir and 3TC in one pill. So next, this gets back to what we started with in terms of questions. Yeah, so it's good if you can do that. But one of the things about actually the boosted protease inhibitor, so if you were to guess, sometimes we have to do this in clinic. We'll have one of these patients who comes through the ER, comes over to clinic. So you guys, if we look at all the patients that we test in the ER, maybe about 30% end up admitted, but 70% don't. They come to clinic. And some come to clinic with really low CD4 counts. And you got to talk to the different docs. I'm giving you my perspective. You might talk to Dr. Patel, and he might give you a very different perspective. Dr. Jenny might give you another one. But I think delay in therapy sometimes is something you really got to take a lot of, you got to be sort of, take a long look at right now. So if you would actually take a patient come in, we like to do resistance tests on everybody. Some patients have baseline resistance, maybe about 3-5% of patients. Now, what are they going to have baseline resistance to? Probably, if we go back, two slides. It'd probably be this group. And it's got to do with sort of the impact of the resistance on in terms of viral replication. But resistance to the non-nucleoside group really doesn't impair the virus very much, and that kind of hangs around. They may transmit that. So if you're going to do exactly what I'm saying is, let's start them on therapy, and then you actually probably would want to use a boosted protease inhibitor, because we don't really see much in terms of protease inhibitor resistance being transmitted. It happens, but not too often, much less than actually this. So if you had somebody in-house, what you want to do is send off, like Fawad said, probably send off the resistance test, and if you were going to start them on therapy, I would say probably picking something from here with here would be probably pretty good. So, resistance tests, you know, we talk about, usually takes about 3-4 weeks to come back. Okay? Next. Why one, you know, nucleoside backbone versus another? So these are actually, when you ever see ACTG, those are usually multi-site, large studies that are done. AIDS clinical trial group. It's usually very, you know, it's a lot of thought goes behind actually the study design. They usually really enroll a lot of patients in them. And usually the results are very impactful in terms of whatever trials they do. Well, they wanted to look actually at what sort of the best regimens are to start patients with. And they varied a few different things, but one was, what was going to be the nucleoside backbone? So this is a once-a-day regimen, Epsicon, and this is a once-a-day regimen called Truvada. And what they looked at actually was, for patients whose viral loads at baseline were higher than 100,000, what happened in terms of virologic failure? Meaning that patients weren't suppressed or suppressed and rebounded. And they saw much more virologic failure, and here's the p-value, 0.0003, for Epsicom versus Truvada. And that actually really changed, I think, how people felt in terms of these regimens and in terms of actually efficacy of these regimens. And so that's why when the guidelines came out after having had both of these as preferred regimens, this was dropped down to an alternative. Doesn't mean you can't use it, but just means keep always in the back of your mind. What Fawad said is resistance, you know, is important, but also baseline viral load seems to be important in terms of choice of the nucleoside backbone. Okay? Next. Another important thing was actually looking at adverse events. So this has been this large study, not done prospectively. It's, you know, they collect data as patients go. It's a clinical study called DAD. It's all over the world. There's thousands and thousands of patients that have been enrolled in this. And they actually have looked in terms of a myocardial infarction, what was the nucleosides these patients were exposed to. And one of the things that actually has come out of this is that Abacavir, this was very surprising, for the group here, was that Abacavir and also in DDI, which was less surprising, seemed to have a signal in terms of myocardial infarction. And no one's really clear why, what exactly it is about, especially about abacavir, but it looks like it actually does have a signal. We haven't seen it really with the other antiretrovirals as much. And it seems like probably the critical phase is that it's a six-month time period after you've been on abacavir. So if you've been off abacavir more than 6 months, we start to see this signal fading into the background. So it's not a permanent, you know, change. So patients who go on and go off of it. Now, not every patient is going to have this signal. The patients actually in this that really had the most risk for myocardial infarction were the patients that usually had 4 or 5 cardiovascular risk factors. So hypertension, male, age greater than 50, diabetic, and then go on abacavir. So it's not your patient that has none and you put them on the drug that you really have to worry about. It's really that patient that has several. But think about our patients, cardiovascular risk factors. We have a lot of cigarette smoking. We do have hypertensives. The average age of our patients at diagnosis is 40, so with time people get near that 50. We do have some diabetics. So you do have to at least consider that in terms of your thinking about antiretroviral choices, especially for the nucleosides. Next. Also in terms of relative risk, they see some signal with some of the protease inhibitors, notably Kaletra. So when we look at that preferred list, Kaletra was one of the drugs on that preferred list, lopinavir, ritonavir. That also had an increased risk for myocardial infarction. Again, if you had several cardiovascular risk factors, as well as did crixivan, which is an older protease inhibitor. So think about those when you choose. You can see the other drugs here. You know, they didn't study every protease inhibitor, but at least nalfinavir looked okay, sequinavir looked okay, and the non-nucleosides looked okay. So, but there's ones missing here that have come out since. So atazanavir and darunavir are not on this list. We'll have to wait for that data to come out. Next. So new drugs that have come out. We have, you know, before we had actually pretty much 3 classes of drugs that we used for our choices. We had nucleoside inhibitors, non-nucleoside inhibitors, protease inhibitors. That was really sort of our regimens. But we've had actually 2 new classes of drugs come out in the last couple of years. So one is an integrase inhibitor, and one is an attachment inhibitor. There's not enough data yet on use of this one, at least in naive patients. This one just got approved for use in naive patients. This drug actually seems to have a cleaner lipid profile than the other drugs we've had. It's one pill twice a day. It doesn't have much in terms of drug interactions. You know, we talk about a TB study. Well, one of the things we have to worry about is rifabutin or rifampin and most of the protease inhibitors. But this one actually is okay to use. You don't have to adjust it. So that's actually a nice drug. And it seems to fare pretty well and definitely does very well in experienced patients. It looks like it actually did well enough in naive patients that the FDA approved it recently to be used for naive patients as well. It's twice a day. You know, we talk about one of the things that's nice in that regimen I showed you is one pill once a day, but this is twice a day. So that's one thing to consider too. It's like the non-nucleosides. If you skip doses on it, you run the risk of resistance. It does have a relatively fragile resistance barrier. Maraviroc, attachment inhibitor, it's a very interesting drug in terms of its development. The data so far hasn't supported it being used for earlier lines of therapy. There's a special test you have to do called the CCR5 trophile tropism test to actually see if your patients would be appropriate for this drug. It's, to tell you the truth, if we want to, I'm not sure anybody would be interested, but this would be a whole hour lecture just going over Maraviroc by itself, and probably no one here would be interested in hearing about it. But it's an interesting drug that's out there. It's probably not ready to be used for first-line therapy, but drug therapies will change over time. So there might be other drugs in this class that actually look better for naive patients. Okay, next. So trend towards earlier initial therapy is what we're starting to see. Our challenge remains to identify patients earlier in infection, but now you guys know we're going to call 5211, and we're going to get patients tested earlier. Got to talk to them. They listen to the doctor. If you just say, we're recommending this for everybody. Really, we think it's a good idea to get tested because in the ER, we can't test everybody. We just don't reach every patient, or they're unstable when they hit the floor, so they go to the MICU, but then they come down to you guys. We want to get them tested. Therapeutic regimens, now there's lots of them, and the selection of the appropriate regimen should be individualized. You know, I told you that tenofovir is a good choice there, Truvada. But if the patient has poor renal function, it's not the right drug. So you do have to take into account some other things that I didn't talk about. Next. All right, we're going to go back to our cases now and give you the answers, because I know that there's some guys out there that really want to know what the answers were to these questions. So RW, they're slightly worded differently, but the same point. 57-year-old Hispanic man presents to your clinic for initial management of HIV infection. He was diagnosed 4 months ago at the local health department after learning exposure from previous sexual partners. He has no signs or symptoms of an OI. His past medical history includes a previous MI, hypertension, dyslipidemia. T-cells are 410, viral load is 78,000. What did we say the current guidelines recommend in terms of starting therapy? 350, right? Okay. Prior to his appointment, you review the lab results and determine that it might be prudent to recommend initiation of ARVs. Next. Go through the DHHS guidelines. Our four choices. We recommend it based on which of the following? His plasma viral load being higher than 75,000? No. He is showing no difference in all-cause mortality when ARV is initiated at CD4 counts between 50 and 500 compared with lower CD4 counts. Is it earlier initiation of ARVs may reduce cardiovascular and other non-AIDS-related disease risks? Yes. The risk of OIs decreases when treatment is initiated CD4 counts greater than 500. That's not true. We know that OIs really, probably the peak of OIs, so it doesn't happen until after the CD4 counts less than 150. So, next. And the answer is earlier initiation of ARVs may reduce cardiovascular or other non-AIDS-related disease risk. CD4 counts and clinical conditions, including consideration of possible benefit in terms of non-HIV-related disease, are generally considered to be more important than the viral load. And that's actually what we're starting to see. Although some experts would start treatment when the viral load is greater than 100,000, a viral load greater than 75,000 would not generally be an indication for treatment. Okay, next. Which lab values or conditions would not influence the choice of initial regimen? So this one actually I didn't hear consensus on in the group. So plasma viral, this is would not influence. So a plasma viral load greater than 75,000, that's the answer. That's the answer. So these are actually things. Now this is different. If we, we go back to the bad house staff from years and years ago who didn't want to start ARV therapy, one of the reasons that they probably didn't want to start ARV therapy was that they were worried about lipids and lipid dysfunction, that patients were actually going to have MIs from the big bad protease inhibitors that they were going to get. But we've actually learned is that people not on therapy, as we went through the slide deck, have more risk for MI than people on therapy. So it's a real change in actual thought behavior. And there's a big study, which I didn't go over, called SMART. What SMART did was, with thousands of patients around the world, one arm continued on therapy. These were all patients that were suppressed going in. The other group started on therapy and stopped therapy based on their CD4 count. So they stayed on therapy until their CD4 count got to 250, and then they restarted therapy. And when it got to 350, they stopped. And the whole reason for SMART was that they felt that if you were off therapy, intermittently on therapy, that you'd have decreased toxicity from the medications. But what happened from SMART? Being on and off therapy, you had increased myocardial risk factors, myocardial infarctions. So that changed everything. So, so in terms of lab values, actually, it's a big plasma, it's a big change in the paradigm that we put people on therapy because we are afraid of myocardial infarction. If they have a history of it, we definitely want to get them on therapy. History of hypertension would not influence our choice. Although we'd have to worry about cardiovascular risk factors, history of dyslipidemia would not influence our choice either. A viral load greater than 100,000 but not 75,000 would argue against the use of abacavir. So if a viral load is greater than 75,000, greater than 100,000 is when we saw abacavir not working so well. Okay. After assessing his readiness to take medication and addressing factors that might limit adherence, you negotiate a treatment plan. He commits to beginning on antiretroviral therapy. Given his current problems and treatment-naive status, is there a class of drugs that should be avoided as initial therapy? Avoiding is kind of a funny word, but you said it over here, CCR5 antagonist. And really, it's just because we don't have good data to support this being used for naive patients. This is good, this is good, this is good. And actually, as the data just came out now, integrase inhibitor raltegravir is also okay to use for initial therapy. But we don't have good data to actually support the attachment inhibitor CCR5 antagonist. That's all this says. To 27-year-old African-American woman screened to your office, test positive for HIV and rapid testing. Western blot confirms positive screening result. Her only risk factor is 4 male sexual partners in the past 5 years. We had a case almost identical to this, this patient, like 2 weeks ago, except that her thing was she had 4 partners in about the last 20 years, including this current partner she was with, for the last 14 years. And what happened was she was followed actually in one of the off-site clinics, and she's been going there for a while, and she had some parotid gland swelling. Doc was sending her to ENT. And then about a month ago, she came in and she was having some shortness of breath. And the doc treated her for a URI. And she used actually the clinic there mostly for just kind of walk-in care. She really wasn't kind of truly engaged. She just PRN. And then she came back to the clinic and she actually was feeling, the respiratory infection wasn't clearing. And they referred her over to the emergency room. And it was on a Sunday and we didn't have a counselor available. And so the ER doc saw, they did a chest x-ray. Chest x-ray showed interstitial changes. And she was sent home on Zithromax. And then she came back 3 days later, still not feeling well. And this time we did have a counselor available. So you can imagine, she's admitted, she had PCP, T-cell count was 9. So what we did, we brought her partner in to get tested, and he tested positive too. His T-cells are about 400. So she's probably harbored the virus for a long time. You wouldn't have picked it up on history. Her history didn't stand out any differently than what I just told you. She had poor partners in the last 20 years. She's not currently sexually active. She has smoked a pack of cigarettes per day since age 14. She has no current medical problems, takes no prescription drugs. Her initial CD4 count is 378. Her initial viral load is 34,000. She wants to start as soon as possible. We had a case just like this also with someone who had T-cells of 800 who came and said, I want to start as soon as possible. And it was really very interesting. Blue-collar worker, a guy who works filling up diesel trucks. He went on the internet, learned all about HIV, and he said, I don't understand why I'm going to have to wait till my T-cells go down to 350. I want to start now. Next. Which of the following would not be an indication to start ARVs in this patient at the time? So this is things that would not be an indication. So would hepatitis B not be an indication? No. If someone has hepatitis B and HIV, we start them regardless of what their CD4 is. Pregnancy, of course, we're going to treat those patients. We don't want to have them transmit. HIV-associated nephropathy, I told you. OI with 375 is very unlikely. The only OI I think I've seen with CD4 is that high, the truth is KS in some of the patients. But it's rare to see an OI in patients. Maybe TB you might still see there. But atypical squamous cells of undetermined significance is not an indication to start ARVs. So if she wants to start, you can start her. There's no reason you can't. But if you were to try to say, I'm only going to start because she has some indicator comorbidities, well, atypical squamous cells is not an indication. Okay. Anybody have questions, things you want to ask? Things you see? No? Not one question, this whole group? Wow. Had a really good lecture. You guys want to get back to the words. So, all right. Okay. If you have any questions, call 5211 to get people tested. All we have to say is just have to offer it to them and say a counselor can come up, discuss it further. And then it's always up to the patient. Patient, doesn't want to get tested, I'm going to get tested. That's it. But at least, these guys are pretty experienced on how to do this. So they have a pretty high success rate of at least getting people offered and tested. And we do see, it's the state of the disease. We see a lot of people that we wouldn't have picked it up otherwise. So, okay. All right. Let me give you this. This is recording. Yeah. 3 seconds.